We resume our meeting, and we're going to talk about primary financial statements. I give the floor to Michelle.
Thank you. I'll start with paper 21A. The purpose of this paper is to address an outstanding issue with terminology used at the January board meeting for our requirements for management performance measures. The board's tentative decisions in January are in paragraph 4. These decisions were taken subject to the staff clarifying which measures are key performance measures and when a measure is specified or defined in IFRS standards. Now, to respond to this need for clarification, the staff think we should replace the term key performance measure with key financial measure of profits or comprehensive income in our proposals from January in order to focus on that subset of key performance measures. If we focus on this subset, we also think instead of referring to a measure specified or defined in IFRS standards, we can be more specific and refer to subtotals or totals required in IFRS standards for the statement of financial performance. So if we move to the question on page 6, does the board agree that we should clarify, firstly, that all entities should specify their key financial measures of profit or comprehensive income, including, at a minimum, those in the annual report? If any of these measures are not subtotals or totals required by IFRS standards, an entity should identify them as management performance measures. And if a management performance measure doesn't meet the requirements to be a subtotal in the statement of financial performance, then a separate reconciliation should be disclosed in the notes between the management performance measure and the most appropriate subtotal or total required in IFRS standards.
I think that I generally agree with where you're heading, subject to terminology. So, looking at the second part of question one, so these any measures that are subtotals or not subtotals or totals required, if what you mean is things like the profit and loss and total other comprehensive income and things that are set out explicitly in paragraphs 81 and 82 and whatnot in IAS 1, then I agree with you. But the thing that made me hesitate was the sort of discussion in the paper that suggested that the subtotals that are talked about in paragraph 85 are not required. And I think that's, I don't think that's, firstly, I think that you only, sorry, if they were subtotals that were in accordance with paragraph 85, I think you include, you intend for them to be ones that are not required using your terminology. Mm-hmm. But I think paragraph 85 is required, so I think we need to refer specifically to other than the ones specified in paragraphs 81A, etc., etc., specifically.
Yeah.
Because I think it's too dangerous to say that a paragraph that it starts off saying an entity shall present is not a requirement.
Anne?
Yes, I support broadly what's happening in question one. On the second dot point, I was thinking, are we referring to what is going to come as we mandate some subtotals? So I was thinking about that as well, and reading these words to mean that this refers to what we are going to do, because we're going to change things and mandate and make subtotals. So I'm assuming that they are in here, and these new subtotals that we will create will be covered by number B.
Yes, that's right. So based on what Sue was saying, it would be subject to putting our new subtotals in paragraph 81 and 82 as well.
Yes. My second point was, I think we haven't adequately addressed multiple MPMs. So I'd just like to flag that at some point we have to think about what our requirements for disclosure and reconciliation will be for companies that present multiple, and plenty of them do.
Well, I agree and support the sense of direction of this. I have exactly the same issue as Sue has mentioned. And I think you have highlighted eventually a need for an annual improvement type of, because I think that, in fact, what you have highlighted is that the term required is already ambiguous in the paragraph that you have highlighted. So to me, that doesn't form a basis to move ahead. On the contrary, I think that would need to be transformed into prescribed or specifically defined or whatever the English would work. But anything that would suggest that what is required in 85 is not required would not have my support. All the more so that I think, in fact, that in practice, the strength of the requirement is not perceived that it should. Otherwise, we would have more relevant income statements to start with. So I think this needs really, but also clarified eventually in the current literature. And I also would want to echo a few comments this morning regarding the annual report. I think we have feedback from the disclosure initiative that highlights that this reference is just not far from being clear. And we have good, in fact, suggestions and thinking from constituents on this to feed our future thinking on this. But otherwise, yes, I suppose.
Nick?
Thank you. Thank you for the paper. I found it clarified lots of the issues that we talked about in previous months. The one outstanding issue that I just wanted to ask about really is, could we see circumstances where adjusted EPS could be an MPN in its own right, or is that ruled out because it's a ratio? Because I suspect many companies may have that as an MPN.
Based on the proposals we have, it would be ruled out as an MPN, but there'd be nothing to stop an entity presenting the numerator or an additional MPN that was consistent with the adjusted EPS in order to disclose it. And what the staff is proposing is to prohibit adjusted EPS being disclosed unless it's consistent with management performance measures.
The only issue there is if adjusted EPS was your only MPM,
yes,
then you have nothing to hang it off. You'd have to sort of almost backward engineer an MPM from it, wouldn't you?
Yes. I mean, something that we did discuss, didn't we, was that we could have an adjusted EPS that was consistent with one of the subtotals we've introduced, such as profit before investing, financing, and tax. So you could have an adjusted EPS that just adjusts one-off financing item. And so it wouldn't be consistent with the management performance measure because it would be consistent with one of our subtotals for statement of financial performance. We haven't thought about that, but that might be something that we need to consider, that an entity wouldn't have a management performance measure because the adjusted EPS would be consistent with one of the IFRS subtotals. We might need to consider that, whether we should permit that to be disclosed.
Martin.
And as I said last time, I don't agree because I think we should not require this measures in the financial statements because I think they're different. If you think that makes sense, we should define it. What we think performance measures should be reported, but I think we should not upgrade this kind of measures to included in the financial statements. When I said it in January, I don't have to repeat that. But if we want to do that, because my understanding was that we want to give users more transparency about what is included, excluded in this measure, then we should require a reconciliation and not require the presentation of these measures in the financial statements, and then as a second item, a reconciliation. If our purpose is a reconciliation, then we should require a reconciliation, but not, I think, in the first instance, say, okay, we require to present it in the financial statements. For me, it's a kind of little bit difference because then our objective is to have a reconciliation and not to upgrade this kind of measures as part of the financial statements.
Sorry, could I just follow up on Martin's comment there? What we're saying is that the only time in which you could actually present it as part of the primary your management performance measure as part of the primary financial statements is if it would fit logically into the structure of the primary financial statement. So if it doesn't fit into that, and if it fits logically into the structure, then in a way a reconciliation becomes a little bit academic because you can see how it flows from the structure. What we think is in a lot of cases, actually, these management performance measures won't fit into the structure of the statement of financial performance and will end up in a reconciliation anyway.
My point is a little bit different because I thought, what is the objective of us doing that? My understanding was objective is to give more transparency how this reconciles to an IFRS performance measure. with that, we should manage what we're saying. We require to present that, and then a second hand you have to reconcile, or we say it's a first hand, require a reconciliation. Because that is the objective why we want to have in the financial statements. For me, it makes a difference. Because then people understand, okay, it's not an IFRS number, it's a reconciliation to a stupid number or whatever number of people using. And therefore, the objective is to give this what is in, what is out in there, but not at the first hand making that a...
Well, I suppose that's what we want.
Right? But we're saying here in A, I understand it. All entities should specify their key financial measures of profit and loss. A requirement to present that number. That was also I understood the January discussion. Maybe I misunderstood it. But
that's what is written in 4A, right?
But yeah. Can I say how I interpret A? Yeah. A says everyone has a key financial measure, and some of those will be IFRS measures. There's a whole population, 50% of all listed companies in some markets, up to 50%, that do not present an MPM. So those people will present something that's a subtotal from the existing income statement. Then to what we're doing in B is what Rachel said. We're trying to say if in addition to those IFRS measures you have an MPM, if it fits in the new format, it can go in. And if it doesn't, it'll be in part three, which is the reconciliation. And many of them won't, so they'll be in three. But in part two, the second dot point, we're allowing them to be on the face, which is what some people do now. Because to not allow them on the face is to actually go against a practice that is already out there in some jurisdictions. So we were trying to accommodate practice.
Is your concern, Martin, that people still won't be able to tell what's included or excluded, even if it's a sort of natural subtotal?
No, I think, am I understanding correctly, that if a company chooses to present a management performance measure in the financial statements or the notes, then the is to reconcile, as opposed to first requiring that you have an MPM in the financial statements or the notes, and then secondly requiring the reconciliation. Yeah.
Why don't we require it? Why don't we require their own definition of equity, their own definition of liability? What they think is, when we're doing that here, and then we asking for reconciliation, I understand that. But my understanding was we will focus on the reconciliation, not why we think it is users want to have this information, because they have it already. They have it in different places, in out of the financials, in management commentary, in earnings releases, whatever. That is not our job to promote the kind of non-IFRS number into the financials. Why should we do that? I don't understand that. And even in the P&L, why should we say, okay, if you don't using this non-GAAP numbers, why should you say, I'm focusing on pre-tax or after-tax or whatever? Why should I do that? I don't understand that. Why? Because that is the focus here. Maybe I'm still misunderstanding. But my focus is, the first is, okay, people should identify what is their key performance measure, even if it's IFRS or non-IFRS. Why? I cannot do that because maybe I'm concentrated on for a pre-tax number, on a pre-tax profit, for after-tax on after-tax, because tax is also relevant. Maybe I'm doing for operating decision on operating profit, for including investment decision, for if I... Why should we do that? I don't understand that. Because my understanding was objective is to get more insight, because that was the feedback that we get from users, a reconciliation from an IFRS number to whatever they use, if they are using that. If they are using that.
The rationale that we put forward when we presented the papers proposing that people should identify a management performance measure or their key performance measure in the financial statements was that users have told us that they get information out of those management performance measures. So they get some information about how the entity views the business, how the entity sees the profitability of the business, and that's why we thought it would actually be useful to require identification.
Yeah, I understand, but there are thousands of information users find useful, which are non-IFRS number. Does it mean that we bring it all into the financials? No. Yeah. I think the focus is on the reconciliation. That was what made.
Okay.
Nick, that you want to...
I'm sympathetic. I think part of the confusion comes from it's in the definition of subtotals in the IFRS world, and that you can have, as long as it fits in, you can have as many subtotals as you like, as long as it provides relevant information to users. And that's why we end up with these different management performance numbers on the face, and hence what we're following through to talk about EPS. For me, the reconciliation is the key thing. That's what provides the insight. And my one worry about saying that if it's based on a subtotal, an IFRS subtotal, if you have two adjustments in there, you're adjusting for two items, let's say restructuring and intangibles. This is slightly taking us into the next paper, I'm afraid. It's actually difficult to provide that reconciliation, a full reconciliation on the face. Mm-hmm. I'm not quite sure how you could do that without going into the detail around NCI and tax that you would need in a note. So I think it's more nuanced, but the reconciliation is the key. See, I can see where we've tried to start with this, that we're actually trying to help what's practiced today and without disturbing what preparers already do today. But it will get complicated once we enter the details of the reconciliation.
But isn't the reconciliation already required by most regulators?
Yes.
Yes.
It's just that it's all over the place in the annual report, and what we're trying to do is to put it in a specified place. People can find it, make it clear.
Yeah. Yeah, and we have decided if it doesn't jive with our subtotals, not required, then it goes into the notes. So.
And Nick's saying that a lot of preparers will have trouble getting this reconciliation onto the face because of the items and things. And then it will go into the notes, and it will automatically flow there. And Martin's raising the question that we have addressed before: is, you know, are we elevating this NPM and making people put it on the face? Whereas we're saying these requirements hopefully are pushing it actually into notes.
Yeah, but that's not what this decision would do.
Yeah,
because if it works as a subtotal, we're saying you have to put it on the face.
Yeah,
if it's your
Well, we think a lot of them won't work. It won't work for a lot of them as a subtotal.
But if it does.
If
we are
does.
Giving them the extra credibility and
which is what a lot of them do now.
And I thought the board's
because they are already allowed to do.
And I thought that I thought it was relevant, so therefore that was the idea. But that's different to Martin's.
Yeah, but I think the objective was to increase the relevance of our income statement. And when you have management that defines the management performance measure, which needs to be taken as an external element with a reconciliation, you detract people from focusing on the income statement, the IFRS income statement. So bringing those MPM measures, when they're consistent with an IFRS within an income statement, to me, forces the relevance of that income statement, first of all, and to me, it creates a hierarchy between the best reporters that fit within the IFRS income statement and those who have to be out because they're external, they just can't fit in, and that's a supplementary sign that there is a discrepancy here.
Suppose you take out infrequent items, then it could logically not fit on the...
It can.
It can.
No, not
it is required by paragraph 85.
It could.
Because then you create a line item of those infrequent items.
Well, it could be all your mark-to-market stuff in theory, depending on how you slice and dice it.
Bank can show, okay, the operating profit before risk, before credit risk, something like that. Fits perfectly into an, and we promoting that. We think it is good because entity thinks, okay, it makes sense, and if they make sense, okay, user thinks it makes sense, and therefore we should bring it into the face of the P&L, which I would not agree, because I think it is okay, we have to define what makes sense in kind of performance statement comparable to others, and that is the job of a standard set. What others are doing, maybe it would make sense in some circumstances, but why should we promote that? I
don't understand. Martin, today they can bring this operating profit. Tomorrow they would have to signal it as a management performance measure.
They can do that, but we are not forcing them to do that. But now we doing that. Because I think...
And it's current practice that they will usually not bother to put it in the income statement, but rather just keep it...
It varies by country. it's a country, very much a country practice.
Yeah.
So if we were looking at UK reports, a lot of people will have one line that goes special items, and then they'll have a note with all the details somewhere else. And they'd be doing that saying that in, with paragraph 85, it makes sense because it's relevant, increases relevance.
So, but in the countries where, as possibly regulators tell them, you cannot do this,
mm-hmm.
they will be very upset about this proposal, right?
The regulators... would,
like in Australia, for example.
Yes, so the regulator doesn't allow that line on the face
yeah.
in Australia.
Yeah.
And then if we had exactly what's in question one, that would then allow people to do it, so we could think that the regulator wouldn't like that.
Yeah. Although I would caveat that by saying that in order for them to be able to strip out those special items, it would the stripping it out would have to fit in with either the function or the by nature flow. And in a lot of cases, what's stripped out with those special items don't cuts across. So it would be, I'm trying to think of an example, but if you had non-recurring items and you were doing it by nature, that's quite difficult to actually fit into the structure. So there would be more restrictions, certainly more restrictions than there are at the moment on those, in those jurisdictions where the regulators take a more relaxed approach to the requirements.
I think there's an underlying question that Martin's bringing up, and it relates to something that we've talked about before. It's the elevating of this MPM onto the face. You know, some people we've had from CMAC before that they don't want that elevated. We don't want that number given credibility. And I think that's Martin's point. And
well, I must say now that I understand it better what it would entail. I'm a bit skeptical myself.
When we had the discussion before in January and other times, there was divided views on whether the MPM should be on the face, and there was a lot of agreement that there should be a reconciliation,
yeah.
and that the reconciliation is the key thing. All around the table, people were saying, you know, yes, they're going to do it. We can't stop them doing it. We wouldn't want to try to stop. We've said that. And we have a reconciliation, so it improves the transparency, and we get the reconciliation located somewhere that people know where to find it, and that helps. And where we've got to in question one, I think, is the staff following the steps of how we're going to get down to the reconciliation. And we've now ended up, and for some of us, we think not many of these MPMs will fit on the face, so they'll be in the note. But as it reads now, Martin's right. We are telling some people, if it fits, you put it on the face.
And I think that's an incentive on the face. I see it as a beneficial incentive.
Tom?
Well, I just wanted to be clear. I think I'm sympathetic to what Martin's saying. So if they have a pile of key financial measures sitting in the background and they haven't stuck them in their management commentary or anything, we're suggesting they take them and put them all in the financial statements.
Yeah.
Is that what I read in that first sentence? All entities should specify their key financial measure or measures in the financial statements.
Under our proposals, if they were reported in the annual report, there'd be a requirement for them to be put in the financial statements, but not if they were communicated only outside the annual report.
Okay, so this, as written, is because you later say, as a minimum, those in the annual report.
Yes.
Finding this is confusing.
Yes, the requirement is for management to identify what it considers to be its key financial measures of profit or comprehensive income. The only requirement, or the only way we would enforce this, is looking as far as the annual report. But yes, if management was only reporting what it considered to be its key financial measures outside the annual report, the idea under these proposals is they would be in the financial statements. But we realise that would be difficult to enforce to require.
It would be difficult to enforce, but I mean, if we worded it that way, presumably auditors would be obliged to try and enforce it.
Mm.
I have a couple of other just questions. So that's one concern, just about how many of these things could show up. Second one, we're talking about, I know earlier it says they're not that common, but There are measures of cash from operations and free cash flow adjusted versions that could be key financial measures. Are they in or out?
Well, under our proposals, we've now narrowed this down to a much smaller subset, so we're only looking at key financial measures of profit or comprehensive income, so just measures of profit. So even measures of single line items would be excluded.
So just to be clear again, so anything that would relate to cash, with cash in the name, would be out?
Yeah.
Okay. Why? If we argue that an entity uses whatever, adjusted EBIT, or adjusted EBITDA is really important to users, suppose they use an adjusted free cash flow, why is that not of interest?
Well, we may come back and look at other key financial measures. It was just, we've had a lot of feedback that the main concerns relate to the statement of financial performance. And so we're specifically in this paper looking at key financial measures of financial performance. But it may be that we might want to come back and look at other key measures of...
I mean, it goes back to the briefing that we originally did on this project, which was that we would focus on the statement of financial performance and we wouldn't look to broaden the project, because we could potentially look at a much wider set of information, including things like cash flow-based performance measures. But what we're trying to do is to focus it down onto the things which we think we can actually do significant improvements on, rather than everything that has the potential to be useful.
Okay. And the other thing, just to confirm again that it's out, if there's something in the front end of a financial statement that the entity says is useful to investors, a profit one, but isn't a key financial measure, then that's out too.
Yes, if it doesn't consider it a key financial measure, yes, it would be out.
Gary?
Thank you. And, I think in general I support the direction of flow, but some questions or comments on both paragraph 7 and on paragraph 12. They're very different. I'll start on 12. We're back to the conundrum of subtotals and what's management number versus not. So if I just focus on two very common subtotals, gross profit and profit before tax. They are not enumerated in IAS-1 as best as I can tell, but they're extraordinarily common. There's nothing controversial. You're just adding and subtracting one IFRS number for another. They may or may not be key performance measures. I don't quite understand what paragraph 12 is trying to get to. I'm assuming that they're not automatically in scope of management performance. I just don't understand 12.
Paragraph 12 is just in the reconciliation that between the management performance measures, that you wouldn't do the reconciliation between the management performance measure and one of the additional subtotals required by paragraph
85. Okay, then maybe I missed the point of 12, but the point I'm making, though, is still thinking. These are very common, pure, nothing controversial about them, but they're not specified.
Yeah.
And whether it's a key measure or just commonly used in an industry or a regulator requires them, or just doing some obvious addition or subtraction. Mm-hmm. I mean, where do they fit in the scope of this thing? Are they just one of these other subtotals that's necessary under paragraph 85 and they're not significant measure, or what are you thinking?
Under our proposals, I think those kind of measures would be captured as management performance measures.
What if they're not? What are these?
And you wouldn't do anything.
I mean, what if they say I'm not one, you know?
If it's not a key financial measure, then it wouldn't be a management performance measure.
It just could be a paragraph 85, other useful subtotal, but not a...
Yes.
And yet, that doesn't come through all that clear in here when it's a non-specified subtotal management number versus just... another useful number that's commonly used. I think we need to deal with that.
Yeah.
And paragraph 7, Tom was hitting at it. Actually, I think, I know we're primarily focusing on the P&L, but I think that might be too restrictive. And the example I've got is when things are going well in companies, things are going okay in companies, okay, maybe it is P&L type measures most important. When things are going downhill, progressively cash flow, capital sufficiency, and so on, get progressively, you know, where you're using your cash, get progressively more important, and the focus on the P&L gets less important. You know, you lose investment grade, it's almost all cash, liquidity, capital. So again, I think, you can just ask the staff, you don't have to react now, but I think we should, don't agree all the time that this should almost always just be on the P&L, and maybe adding to Tom's comment, I think you should probably bring it back.
Darrell?
So a couple of points. I think just generally I agree with the direction staff taking, so I was fairly comfortable with that. It starts out with me taking note of the fact that we have restricted it only to the income statement. And I think your comments in paragraph 6 were the reason why you've done that, and I would be supportive of that. But essentially what we've heard is that that's where users believe these are used. Mostly that's where users believe that the most controversy sits. Just to Gary's point about whether or not gross profit is or isn't controversial, I think the problem with a lot of these things is it's not so much the controversiality or not, it's the definition of or not. So companies can have different definitions of what is gross profit. So using that as a reconciling item for me is a problem because of that. Whereas on other line items, a line item like revenue or a line item like profit and loss, we've been quite clear about what the definition of those items is. And as we go through the process with something like EBIT, the idea is to be clear on what the definition of it is. So that anchor, I think, becomes important. On the issue of whether we should be doing this or whether in doing this we are lending credibility to, and I think Anne quoted a number a little bit earlier where she said the percentage of people that are already using APM. I think the credibility or that those numbers are already in use. They're already out there. People are already applying them. I'm not sure anything we do makes all that much difference in this space other than to give them more, make them more robust in the way they apply it, which I think is our objective. On the paragraph 85 issue, my reading of the way paragraph 85 is written is if I have a key performance indicator that's based on something like operating profit, it seems to me 85 would then state that that is a relevant measure that should already be set out. Right. So I don't think we're adding anything new to the income statement. If it's reconcilable, I think 85 has probably already triggered it. Mm-hmm. So I'm not uncomfortable with the idea of that coming through either. I don't think that's added anything new. And then I think I got quite confused then about the discussion about what is reconcilable and not. So if it is profit and loss, or if it is EBIT in the new space, we wouldn't require any reconciliation, but we would still require a statement that that is the key performance management number that management uses.
Yes.
If it is something like gross profit, because I have essentially reconciled it on the face of my income statement by getting down to it, or operating profit, I've provided a reconciliation to how I determine that number. I wouldn't require another reconciliation to re-reconcile it, if that makes sense. So the reconciliation only kicks in the third circumstance where the number cannot logically be, okay, then I think I'd be comfortable in that space as well.
Mary?
I basically agree with everything Darrell said, and as I was listening to our earlier discussion, subject to Sue's first point about we have to be precise in the language we use, because I think if it is presented as an additional line item pursuant to paragraph 85, then it is a required item. And I think it teaches us two things, communication and speaking precisely. I think the communication point is, before we get into this, we're trying to address providing the reconciliation for those management performance measures that entities use outside the financial statements but within the annual report. And I'm going to accept that constraint of annual report right now. We should be saying there's a lot of mixed practice. We want to emphasize the requirements that we've already introduced into IS-1, which says on the face of the P&L, you can only have a line item or subtotal if all the items in it are IFRS measured amounts. And I think some of the consequences to me are you can't have constant currency on the face. And, you know, another thing is, and it's got to be compatible with function or nature, the choice you have to make. And if it...
But then it can also not be infrequent items because we...
Exactly. In many cases, so that's why I think we're finding monsters under the bed that aren't really there in terms of giving undue prominence, because the instances in which an entity will be able to present it on the face of the P&L, remembering these other requirements, will be limited to me to those instances in which it's basically going to be required by paragraph 85. If you say, this is my management performance measure, and all the amounts are measured in accordance with IFRS, and it can be presented as, it meets the requirements, can be, I think paragraph 85 would say, well, if it's your management performance measure, I don't see how it's not relevant. And if it is relevant, then I think you'd have to present it on the face. I don't think practice is there. But, I think, so to Martin's concern about are we giving undue prominence, I think the only time we're going to say you must present it on the face of the statement of financial performance is when it meets the requirements for function versus nature, and it are amounts measured in accordance with IFRS standards. And in that case, I think it's relevant and it's appropriate as the line item.
Coming back to this infrequent thing, just 10 minutes ago, the staff or
people
around the table said this could be done.
Well, I'm getting agitated.
I'm completely confused now.
Right, I was getting agitated when we were saying that, and I think we were just focusing on this item without standing back and remembering the other requirements we have.
But if that is all the case, isn't then basically the gist of what we're doing is if you use an MPM somewhere, then you, in 95% or perhaps even 99% of the cases, you just have to present it in the notes with a reconciliation.
But do we really think that we, if a company now reports operating profit before share-based compensation, that is required under 85 to present it on the face of the P&L?
That
is what you say.
No,
that is what you have said.
No, hold on.
I don't think so.
Hold on, Martin.
No.
I think the first question is, how is operating performance before share-based payment consistent with presenting items by function or by nature?
Yeah.
And if it isn't, and I would struggle to see how you can have gross profit without employee costs or employee compensation without share-based payments, I think you get kicked out of showing it on the face.
You could potentially do it if you had it by nature, because by nature you could have employee costs and you could...
Other than share-based payments.
Other than share-based
payments. This is one example, but you are saying, man, that is for me key. If it is a key performance measure, then it is required by 85 to put it on the face if it meets the other requirements.
Yes.
Even if it does not make, I would make saying sense, because you're excluding items which I think is part of the performance. That is required, and then that is my share base. For a bank, if is excluding, for example, risk provisioning, they could do it. If they're using that as a key performance measure, you think, say, okay, it should be included as a requirement to include this bullshit measure into the face of the P&L. I really don't think so.
Seems to me the difference for me between paragraph 85 and what the staff is proposing, if I accept all the stuff Mary said about it having to be by nature, function, in accordance with IFRS and all of that, which I'm hoping is a given.
Yes, that's a given.
They need re-emphasising.
Yeah, I'm re-emphasising that, but I'm assuming that's all the case. At the moment, under paragraph 85, you need to be able to convince me that it's relevant. Whereas now, if I've declared that it's a key metric that I've decided is a key metric, maybe it gets a free pass. Now, to your point, if you think it's your key metric, my assumption would be it should be relevant.
That's what I meant by paragraph 85.
I read 85 to be relevant to understand the P&L line items.
I think it could be a different conversation with your auditor, which I think is what Martin's getting at. Because I think at the moment the assumption would be that when I apply 85, I've got to convince the auditors that it's relevant to an understanding to exclude share-based comp or whatever his example was. Whereas now, arguably, as long as I say, yes,
I use that as a key metric, it's been blessed.
Relevant, right.
I think that's the difference.
Yeah.
And it's a subtle difference, but I think it's slightly different. But I think management would always argue the thing they think is important is relevant.
And my point in looking at this section is, first of all, I would not support the staff proposals in question one if we screw up paragraph 85 and in any way suggest that paragraph 85 is a, if you want to, you can, but you don't have to. Paragraph 85 is a requirement. And if you're presenting it because of paragraph 85, it's required. I think Sue had a workaround for that in terms of explicitly specified.
But Martin's example, so a bank provides a line, a subtotal, okay, profits before risk.
Well,
would that be, and it's,
I think arguably they could do that under this proposal, but they couldn't under paragraph 85.
Why not?
Because you'd have to convince your auditor that it's relevant to look at a bank's performance before credit risk, which I hope is a difficult argument to run.
That is my whole point. We're making this kind of what management thinks makes sense.
Yeah, I think we are we are introducing a new relevance.
Yeah, exactly. And that could
just look at the confusion around this table. I'm getting extremely concerned.
Well, but the reason I said that I think we have to be very concerned about communication and also about speaking precisely, I'm not going to express any view on whether you could or couldn't do that profit before risk, because we have been focusing on non-financial institution rather than financial institution, and I just haven't reminded myself about, you know, how the general requirements apply in that circumstance. But I think we have to, what I was trying to get to saying is, an entity should specify what their management performance measures are, which is the requirement in, you know, the proposed requirement in the first part of the question. And I think identifying what it is makes sense. One of the reasons we should require you to identify it, if you have it, is so that we then have a hook for requiring reconciliation. And we say, but by the way, and the second point is, if it's something that, you know, can be presented as a line item or subtotal, presenting it on the face of the statement automatically provides you with that reconciliation. You don't have to repeat it in a note. Somebody may say, well, maybe I don't want to present it on the face. And, you know, the question I then would have is, you say it's your management performance measure and it fits into formatting with all the other requirements. Tell me why it's not relevant and therefore required, but that's a discussion to have with your auditor. And so, okay, I get there for one and two, and then if you're kicked out of presenting it on the face, and, you know, Anne's view is, and I think it's right, that many of these management performance measures would not fit, especially with the functional nature consistency requirements, then you got to reconcile it in the note. I think we need one to make sure we pick up the ones that fail presentation.
But this all requires a lot of text.
Yeah. No, but I mean, it's walking through a decision tree.
But again, so practice in certain countries is even if it passes that relevance test, IAS 1, that in some countries you are still not allowed to put it.
I think they are now, surely.
To define.
Now we've amended IAS 1.
Yeah. No, there's regulators that have taken a position that they are not going on the face.
But
so maybe it's changed.
Well, I don't know how they're complying with IAS 1, paragraph 85.
Yeah. Because 85 focuses on providing a subtotal that is increases the relevance. And sometimes all people want to do is have a line item exclusion. So they want to make an underlying to EBIT. They want to have an EBIT and an underlying.
It's a higher relevance test in some jurisdictions, basically.
And
it sounds like it.
If you could satisfy the function and nature requirements, I think it would be hard for a regulator to say you can't.
Could I ask a question just to clarify this idea that it's unusual or it would be hard to have it flow on the face of the P&L? I may have missed it, but have we taken any decisions about whether a columnar P&L would be acceptable? Because it seems like in a columnar situation, you could pretty much put anything on the face of that P&L, and perhaps a well-intentioned company, that's a relevant measure and that's an additional thing to communicate. But for a company that maybe wants to manipulate how it's presenting itself, it wouldn't be that hard to just use another column, say it flows within the column, and now you get the prominence on the face.
I think we've considered and said no to columns.
Yeah.
Well,
performance.
Yes, we looked at whether a columnar approach to presenting the management performance measure would be an approach that we could go down in terms of requiring, and the answer to that was no. We wanted to go for the approach that was outlined in question one. We didn't specifically address whether columns were prohibited or not.
I think IFRS. We probably should bring that back then and do that.
Why are you
that?
Well, I think there is another element in this paragraph 85 which has a role to play, which is that it should be presented and labelled in a manner that makes the line items that constitute the subtotal clear and understandable. So referring to the discussion that went on around gross profit and operating profit, gross profit and operating profit by themselves are not labelled in a manner that conveys well how the subtotal is constituted. So in fact, what we would be doing to what exists today, because if you have if you bring, for example, an operating profit line, then you would have to, it would be a management defined operating profit, meaning you have to provide the definition just as Darrell said. And if you had profit before income tax and you have income tax as a line item and profit as a line, you don't have. I mean, this would fit 85. So you have two distinct populations. Also, I think when we look at the relevance of a subtotal, we're not looking at the at a measure which encompasses every element. By definition, it's a subtotal, so it's a share. It's a component of the performance. So the fact that some elements are shown separately is not a distinct attack to relevance. It's just showing things in components. So if you have a stream of revenue and you have the impact of risks, these are two components of your performance. Maybe it's relevant, maybe it's not, but it's not, by definition, not relevant to put something below a subtotal.
Thank you.
Yes. Generally, I agree with staff's selection and the clarification of to the general meetings. I'm thinking that based on previous discussion, there's some confusing there. I think there's three questions asked. I think first question is really important. The first question is clear, and then it's better to understand the second and the third. I have several suggestions, comments. First, the first question, we use the term of the key financial measure. I would suggest to add one word, key financial performance measure. That means we are still focusing on performance measure, not other measures, not non-performance measures. So it can limit our scope of the financial performance financial measures. So this is the first suggestion. Second suggestion is that we use the term of specify. How to understand specify? If those subtotals has been required, such as subtotals of profit or loss or compensated income has been required by IS1 and the entity has been disclosed on the face of the financial performance statement, whether the entity still needs to specify, I think it's not necessary because they have disclosed that. So I'm wondering whether we would like to address, originally we used the term IFIs, defined financial performance measure. So is it, we try to quote that IFIs defined measure, this is what we are focused on. If we are focused on, actually it is defined or required by the standards, not the entities specified those financial performance measures. So this is also another question come out. Who should specify? Is the standards based on our IFIs, IFS 1 paragraph 81A specified profit and loss, total comprehensive, other comprehensive income, and comprehensive, also 85 or 85A, there are some requirements, discipline for subtotals, total stock. So I think we need to make clear, is standards specified or entity can specify anyway. Yeah, so, but it's relevant to the previous term we used, IFI defined performance measure, whether the first question will focus on this one or it's quite broad, including the IFI defined measures or other, including, you know, management performance measures totally.
I think the easiest way would be possibly list the subtotals in, mm-hmm. or have a paragraph that lists the subtotals that we can, that we're referring to, and to reference to the paragraph, reference the subtotals listed in that paragraph. That'd be,
so I think we mean paragraph 81.
81, it's a very, yeah, only mention 81. Yeah.
Plus to Anne's point, if we add EBIT and things like that, we'd need to add those to the list.
Amaru.
Thanks, Hans. I think Jin Chao's comments almost clarified what I had in my mind, but I just would like to follow up and for you to clarify. So we started out as focusing on the MPMs. So what we have here is, after all the discussion, yes, we are not messing or changing anything in IS-1. So 8.1, 8.5, 8.5A do over, are the umbrella to all this, right? So they have to have observed 8.5 and 8.5A in particular when they are creating subtotals. So then the three questions are, well, the first one, it's not really about the primary financial statement in itself. It's a new request for all entities that use IFRS to define what they view as their financial performance measures, right? So the first question, we are not talking about structure or composition or anything. We are just adding something that is new. We didn't have this. Perfect. That's fine. If you all agree, it's necessary to be very clear. So the second one, the second question is, well, you know, if the management performance, the financial performance measure that you identified is not a subtotal or total required by the IFRS, it's not required, your entity should call this MPM.
Yes, sir.
You should call MPM, but you have to follow 8.5 and 8.5A, and you have to be very clear on that, right? Am I right?
Yes, they'll be collectively referred to as management.
Okay, that's fine. But again, you have to observe all this, make sense, be relevant, blah, blah, blah. And then comes the third one, the third question. I think the third question is incorrect in a sense, and I would say, well, if an MPM does not meet the requirements, oh, but if it will be an MPM only when they not meet the requirement to be a subtotal. Because you just told me that if the measure is not a subtotal required, it's an MPM. So an MPM would only be an MPM if it's not required as a subtotal.
Yeah.
Right?
Right.
Yeah. That is what's written here.
That's not what they meant.
Yeah,
go to the second question. Yeah. The second question says, the measure is not a subtotal or a total required by the IFRS, it's an MPM.
This is going back to the point I think that Sue made right at the beginning of this, that there are two sort of subsets of required subtotals. There are the ones that are required by, I think it's paragraph 80, which lists out comprehensive income, profit after tax, as being specifically required.
Perfect.
Yeah, and that's the ones that we're referring to in the second bullet point. So those limited population, which would include those additional subtotals that we're introducing as part of this project. So our EBIT subtotals.
That's right.
In the third bullet point, what we're effectively so the second bullet point ignores, if you like, the paragraph 85
subtotals. That's fine.
Yeah.
That's fine.
Now those are required, although there is some confusion in the language in IS1, which implies that they don't use the term required to refer to those, but 85 makes it clear that those are required. But in the second bullet point, we're only referring to those specified subtotals.
Perfect.
The third bullet point is saying, well, actually, you might be able to fit in another subtotal, not one of those that were specifically required by IS1, but might be required by paragraph 85 of IS1.
You can use paragraph 85 to add
an additional one, and that could be one of your management performance measures. If that's the case, then you can present that on the face. If you can't present it on the face, and then you end up having to do it in the notes.
So, but the question is still incorrect, because it does meet the requirement, because it's fitting into 85, and that's the focus of my question. That's the problem.
We need to reword the
question. Yes.
That's the problem I have in here.
That's going back to the point Sue raised at the beginning, and we acknowledge that actually we've written this isn't very clear, that actually it would be clear.
And I think that's in my view, the whole discussion, that's the main point. It's just a matter of clarify what we really meant by specified or required, that we are not really changing anything in IS1. And then we'll be back to the main objective of reconciliation as stressed by Martin.
I'm not sure if that's true, though, is it? Because you could, in theory, I think, subject to the long discussion we've already had something that is a management number which wasn't required by paragraph 85A, but which is a key performance measure, which would now be included. So that's an addition, right?
Yes, yeah. That would have to be disclosed in the notes.
Not if it was a subtotal that worked.
Yeah.
You would have to provide additional...
We don't have this discussion here at this point. And I think this is the key aspect of Martin.
So in theory, if you had a subtotal which worked, that you weren't required to provide by paragraph 85, but that was a key performance metric of management, we would be saying you now have to put that on the face.
Yeah. Although it's quite a difficult argument to run that it's a key performance metric, but...
In which case, I don't know why we even need to do these things, because IS1 always already requires it. If that's true, I didn't think that was what we were deciding. But
That's my point. That's why I followed that. That's why I think Martin has an excellent point. What we are trying to do, if we're doing
something new, we will.
Yeah.
Because otherwise we're undermining paragraph 85.
Yes, and I don't want to undermine that.
Paragraph 85 isn't read in that way a lot of the times at the moment.
That's compliance.
I think that there might be the point of hearing I will make. We need to emphasise.
We need to emphasise what?
That you would probably get there anyway, and that we just reaffirm it. If something is a key performance...
If that is the case, why are we doing this now?
I'm
starting to get very worried. Yeah,
we are focusing quite a lot on the ones that would actually fit within the structure of the performance statement anyway. And actually, what we've said is that we think, because of the restrictions that are imposed on the structure of the statement of financial performance, many of these will actually end up in the notes of reconciliation anyway. It's that small population that would actually fit that we're arguing about here.
Could I have a smaller population, which is ones that don't meet 85, that are key performance measures?
I'm reading 85. You have to convince your auditor that if you add in subtotal, that this is necessary to understand the performance of an entity. If we do that, what the staff is proposing now, my understanding is that people can argue, that is my key performance measurement, so it must have relevance, and therefore it has to be included as a subtotal in the... And that is total difference, because currently I don't read 85 that if management identifies that as a key performance measure, that automatically it has to be, and it does make sense. It is absolutely total difference from thinking.
There's a really quick empirical question, because I don't get the sense that that's what's happening at all, that people are reading 85 and saying what Martin just said,
if it's a key performance measure, it must be relevant, therefore I will use 85.
Now that doesn't work. Now it doesn't work. The inquiry is that in the future, if we say...
But that's my... Do we have any empirics on how many people are interpreting
this, your standard.
This way? Because it's... That's...
I mean, I think Martin's worry is now we say that people will read our proposals, that we think that management performance measures are so important they need to become
automatically tick boxes.
And that means that they get much more relevance, and that it's much easier in a discussion with your auditor.
Yeah. Hans, I have trying to take Martin's concerns to heart and make peace with him, and thinking about how we've got ourselves in knots, I have a suggestion for a way to phrase this that might take away a lot of the confusion, which is if instead of question one is drafted, if the proposal is, if an entity has identified a management performance measure that is not a line item or subtotal presented on its state of presented on the face, sorry, I'm not being precise in my language, violating my own rules, but and thinking about Jing Dao's points about language in this, but if an entity has a management performance measure, see section that discusses when you have a management performance measure. Has a key financial performance measure. If an entity has a key financial performance measure that is not a line item or subtotal presented on the statement of financial performance, then it must provide a reconciliation of that in the notes. So we will accomplish a requirement to identify a key financial performance measure if it's not a line item. If it is a line item and in the operating performance review or somewhere else in the report, they are talking about operating profit or something else that is a line item, there's no diminution in the relevance, et cetera. If they are using a key financial performance measure that is not a line item, we're saying it's got to be reconciled, identified and reconciled. I think that we've learned that we still need to do communication effort around what IS1 does and does not allow you or require you to present as a line item and subtotal. But I think we can collapse all the confusion that we've just had if we say, if you have a key financial performance measure that is not a minimum, that is not a line item or subtotal presented on the statement of financial performance, then you must provide a reconciliation of it in the footnote.
A very line item or
subtotal?
Subtotal, I think. Subtotal or total?
A line item or subtotal. And we have paragraph 81, 85, and 85A that tell you what you must and may have for line items and subtotals.
That's what I said 1 hour ago.
Yeah.
But I think that would accomplish what we want.
Does that work?
I just wanted to clarify what Mary was saying. So one of the things that we were saying in here, which I think is the thing that Martin objected to most in our proposal, was that we were saying, well, you must identify a key financial measure.
What your key financial performance measure.
Yes.
Picking up Jing Zhao's edit, which is important.
Yes, although actually I'm not sure we need financial in there because we performance in there because we specify profit or loss or comprehensive income, which I think implies the performance piece. So are you saying that you would move away from a requirement to identify a key financial measure?
I think yes, because If we have a section that says here's when you have a key financial performance measure, if you talk about it in the operating performance review, the MD&A, all the stuff we have about how do you know when you have it, if you have one that is a subtotal, I think we don't have any of the concerns.
Okay, so rather than saying you must identify one, you're saying if there are ones in the front half, broadly speaking, then you should, and it's not a total or subtotal, then you must provide the reconciliation in the notes.
That is simple.
No, it doesn't work.
Okay.
It's too simple. Okay, it doesn't. I'll tell you why it doesn't work, because
ultimately we need to say, and this, sorry, I know we're getting to the next paper, but ultimately we need to take this down to EPS. And in a world where we're not defining what's recurring and non-recurring, the deal is that analysts can actually say, I will accept that adjustment and I will reject that adjustment. Mm-hmm. So even though it may appear if it's a line item, you then need to have the data. Let's say you've got two adjustments mm-hmm. there, one of which is for restructuring and the other which is, let's say, for share-based compensation. Mm-hmm. And you're willing to give them the benefit of the restructuring but not the share-based compensation. Mm-hmm. When you get down to the EPS level, you need more information to make that adjustment. We can come on to it.
I think we come on to that because EPS is, to me, outside what we're talking about as line item or subtotal.
But it doesn't work unless you have defined. I can't see then how you make the link to getting to that adjusted EPS without having defined a management performance measure, because then I'm not sure what you're adjusting. We've lost a kind of defined number.
Well, can I ask Martin a question on that one? Would you be as concerned if we were saying, in item, saying at the beginning, first you must identify what your key financial performance measures are. Just identify. It doesn't say put them on the face. Just identify. And say, if the item or items you identify are not a line item and subtotal, then you must reconcile it. But I think, Nick, the you must identify what they are would answer your what's the hook for adjusted EPS.
Yeah, potentially.
That's why I meant the first question is totally different from the others. I think the first question makes total sense because we are responding to a request. It's not a structure or format or anything. We are creating something new. And then we'll respond to Nick's concern. I would be okay with the first question.
Finally, asking on your suggestion. There are three types of subtotals. If you say that the final category of this kind of pure NPL, you are saying identify that and require reconciliation. Then, what is the difference between the second category, IAS 185 subtotal, and this one? Because there is no different requirement at all. In the category two, they have to make some kind of subtotal and reconcile them. And this one is also their reconciliation. Then their relevance about IS 185 is losing. Is why we need 85?
The reason I was making the suggestion to simplify the expression of the reconciliation is I think this whole thing has taught us that we need to do education and comment around what the current requirements of that are. And then we might get better practice about what the line items and subtotals are and are not. And I think we should do that without regard to whether or not we're requiring reconciliation.
And Jiang Wu, the problem is that if we in IAS 85 is saying, okay, you have to include it if it is relevant to understand.
Sure.
If we now making with this proposal saying all this kind of management performance measures are so relevant that we have to include it in the financial statements, we have overcoming this hurdle. Automatically saying, okay, these are relevant.
Yeah,
exactly.
And no auditor can then challenge any kind of number because we have said, okay, it is a relevant information to understand the performance of an entity. That's the reason why we bring it into the financial. And if we're doing that, then in 85, this problem is to understand the financial performance is already done for all this kind of MPMs. That is the difference.
Yeah.
And therefore, I think
we have a real problem here.
I'm not sure we have a big problem. First of all, I would not necessarily assume that a management performance measure is by definition something that should not be shown. I think it runs a lot of chances of being relevant. So I think we would be in a better place looking at those things more positively. Second thing I think that we should not forget is that we've heard from users that management view of performance brings insights into the governance of the entity. So identifying measures subtotal as being those some totals that are used internally as key performance measures, eventually for compensation for whatever, I think brings useful insights. And also we should not forget that if the conditions in paragraph 85, which is pretty well-defined and restricted, are not met, with these management performance measures being inserted when they fit, you add the requirement to provide the definition. And I would be interested to see what we have as, you know, in our best practice part of the taxonomy, what we have with operating profit and gross profit, those measures that we referred to, which are commonly used, and whether they're tagged with their specific definition. Because I think one of the things that our discussion today revealed is that having those definitions is absolutely key in understanding the information that we convey.
We do in the taxonomy have elements for gross profit and for operating profit, but of course, as you say, we have no definitions of what those are, so whether those numbers actually end up being comparable, I think, is questionable.
So we would have, I mean, in doing what we suggest, we would make up for this shortcoming, because every time you would have a definition, a subtotal of which label does not convey the composition, you would have the trigger of making the definition necessary as a disclosure. And on top of it, additional benefit, you bring the insights into the management of the entity. And if it doesn't fit, you still have the reconciliation. But it's, you know, second grade.
Tom?
I'm still back with my empirics question. I just want to understand something in all this. About, it doesn't sound to me, from my casual looking at these things, that many people are using 85 to shove these management measures into the statements at present. Is that your read? Because I have never, and when I read 85, it says, if presentation is relevant, I have never read one management non-GAAP or AF, whatever, APM, where management started off by saying, this isn't relevant. They actually say, they all say, this is relevant to our users. And yet none of them use 85, which was my earlier question, which is why I ask. So I'm really curious about the dynamics of how people
are
interpreting.
Perhaps the auditor doesn't allow it because he thinks it's shady.
I'll just sort of finish and then I'll take the answers. So I'm really curious about the dynamics, and I think the dynamics, I don't understand them, it makes me really sympathetic to, I think, Martin's view about this. Whatever we do is going to change this dynamic significantly, because it doesn't follow to me that they shouldn't be using 85. And I think it is going to change radically if we give this signal. And I just try and understand that better. So I apologize. I'll let you answer.
Tom, I don't think you can say they're not using 85.
Well, that's why I asked. I asked the empirical question.
I
don't know.
We've gone through the words of what 85 says. A line item or a subtotal if it's relevant, and consequently some regulators and some companies, therefore their auditors, allow a presentation on the face with lots of line items and subtotals, and when you look at it, one could assume that it's inconsistent with 85.
That's why I asked about the incidence. My sense is that the incidence is nowhere where we would have expected it to be, given what they say about these items and given what 85 says. The incidence is well below that. That's why I asked an empirical question. And that's why I asked you guys. And they said they didn't think it was being used.
Well, no. I think we're saying that actually, I think the problem is that people don't specifically refer to paragraph 85 when putting the structure on their profit and loss account. The research that we did when we originally started out this project suggests that there's an enormous diversity in the way that performance statements are presented across the globe. A lot of it depends upon what the regulators allow and permit, and a lot of it depends upon past history in terms of previous gaps. And part of the reason why we're doing this project is to try and introduce sort of more comparability across country and actually more structure into the statement of financial performance to allow that sort of additional comparability. And so what we do see is we see a lot of what could be described as additional line items or subtotals being included in the statement of financial performance in those jurisdictions where the regulators permit that, but whether actually that's in directly sort of following what paragraph 85 says, we just don't know.
Given this enormous diversity in practice around the world, is first of all, I think that what we have been doing in terms of defining subtotals and line items is much more important than this. And the question is, shouldn't we limit ourselves to that, creating a little bit more order in the chaos? Should we perhaps even go a little bit further than we have done, rather than introducing this very complicated discussion, which is necessarily not completely comparable, which doesn't create the true comparability?
This goes back to the sort of the two aims that we were trying to do with the project, and of course we can reconsider what those two aims were. The first one was to introduce comparability, and that was the additional subtotal.
Yeah.
But also we were told that users appreciate the insight that you can get from these sort of management performance measures, etc. And so what we were looking to do was to provide some additional disclosures around those management performance measures so that they can get that additional insight and, if necessary, make changes to the adjustments that managers are making, etc. So what we're trying to do was to if you like, take those two.
I understand. Yeah.
Now, I mean, if we want to back away from that and just go towards looking at providing more structure to the income statement, then we can certainly do that. But that's a big shift from, I think, where we were originally.
We can do the second part, the second objective, through a reconciliation. But where the disagreement's coming is whether these we should mandate onto the face or encourage or permit or onto the face for a whole lot of companies that have MPMs and don't put them on the face.
Yeah.
That's where the
concern
where
the,
is.
That's a problem.
So
I think if it were just to happen in the notes, I don't think many people.
No, there's been a lot of agreement around the table that a reconciliation would be useful. It will fit with the feedback we've got. We're going to think about part one. We'll have lots more subtotals in there, and we'll be saying reconcile using those the closest one, which is what IAS 1 says now, reconcile to the closest one, so that we can require a reconciliation without touching the display of the MPM.
Nick? Taxing, sorry, we
about sorry.
For a lifetime.
Thank you. Yeah, just a small point. Actually, Francois started talking about it in her first opportunity about revenue. So in your paragraph 9, you said adjusted revenue cannot be the MPM. So revenue is not a subtotal, but it's a line item. There might be some entity who definitely have adjusted revenue as a key performance measure. The question is whether it's an IFRS number or not. So something like a consistent currency basis revenue cannot be IFRS number. However, say for example, you have a selling cars in the United States and the number of car is increased by 10%, but because of the foreign currency exchange, the revenue number in your functional currency declined. So they want to provide the information that actual number of car has increased. So of course you cannot provide number of cars. However, you could provide number of sales in your US subsidiary, which is denominated in US dollar. That is the financial number. Would it be MPM, or do you prohibit such numbers as an MPM?
As an adjusted revenue, it wouldn't be an MPM under our definition, but you may have an MPM that made adjustments for like a measure of management's profit that made an adjustment as one of its adjustments, an adjustment for revenue.
The key point is that the way that we define MPMs is that it should be a measure of profit or comprehensive income, so a single line item like revenue couldn't be an NPM according to our definition.
Yeah, that's the point I wanted to articulate first, because you say it's subtotal, but Mary was keep saying it's line item or subtotal. So that is the point. Even if revenue itself is a line item, not a subtotal, but normally revenue could be kind of a number like a profit subtotal. So therefore, I don't understand why, because it's just a line item, only because it's a line item, it can't be NPM.
It was in our original proposals, but since reducing it down to this subset, it will no longer be there.
Nick?
Yeah, really just trying to suggest a simplification, because I'd rather not give up on this altogether. But we need something that's simpler from the discussion we've had already. I wonder if we simply ask companies to specify key financial performance measures, and if those measures aren't based on those very small number of defined subtotals, that they have to provide reconciliation in the notes.
Yep.
The end. And that will result in duplication for some companies, because they may feel that's already done within their P&L. Accept that, but it provides some simplicity. Users will know they look for this in one place. It will always be in the notes. They won't have to look for it either in the notes on the face, and it just cuts through a lot of the discussion that we've had already.
Is it correct that the difference between what I was saying, and I think what Martin said he was saying before, and what you just said,
I think is
line item. Is whether you include line items. You said only subtotals.
Yeah, I did.
And you, when you said defined, do you mean
the small number
specified?
Yeah, exactly. Yeah,
required or specified.
Yeah. So it will potentially result in some duplication, but it does bring simplicity.
Tom.
Oh, just a quick follow-up to Nick's comment. In their big survey that the CFAs did, the most popular spot for additional stuff was the notes, not the statements proper, which was a surprise to me, but I could get you the specific numbers. I don't have them here, but it was quite pronounced, which would be consistent with what I think Nick just said as a compromise.
Well, I understand that we are about to leave that aside, and I really regret it, because I think if we do what is just suggested now, we do nothing but bring within the notes something that is already requested by regulators, no more, and we don't help. I don't think we do much to in this part of the income statement. We don't do much in order to enhance the relevance of that income statement. And we also, to me, it was really important to that entities that we have key performance measures that fit as subtotals would be distinguished from those who don't. And now we're going just to put everybody in the same basket. And I think it's regrettable that we eliminate these possible enhancements. I would agree that it's not fundamental, but I regret that we undo all the thinking behind that.
Mary,
On Nick's suggestion, I think in the basic point of line items and subtotals or just subtotals and specified, I think I don't care that much whether we say preliminary view is X, but we really want information about the other approach or vice versa, because to me, it would elicit information about whether people care more about having the reconciliation always in the same place, or whether they only want a reconciliation if it isn't obvious from the front.
We got a very clear message from users, easy to find reconciliation.
Okay. Mm. But okay. Yeah. I think I don't know, and I'd like to hear maybe what preparers think about the burden of having to say, as we said in our statement of profit and loss, this item minus this item equals this item. You know, and
we could say unless provided on the face in accordance with paragraph 85 and 85A, couldn't we?
Well, Nick was saying
don't. I want it in one place.
Nick was saying don't allow 85 or 85A to get you out of the reconciliation. Only allow paragraph 81 to get you out of the reconciliation. As I said, I think we could go.
The whole discussion starts again.
Yeah. No. Yeah. I think we could go. Yeah. Either way, I think the basic source of confusion and concern in the discussion before is whether that we would somehow write this in a way that legitimized presentation on the statement of profit or loss of something that would not otherwise pass. You could call it the smell test, or you could call it more precisely the requirements of IS-1. I think some of the stuff that several of us, including me, were saying about, tell me how you come to the conclusion you don't have to do it under 85A if it meets the requirements. That's a practice application issue, and maybe that's clouding the discussion, and we should shove it aside. Because I think that's about how you apply, think about the requirements that together in IS-1, but let's take that as a separate issue. But, Nick, in terms of whether we simplify it all the way down to always have a reconciliation in the notes or have a reconciliation in the notes only if it isn't, in effect, satisfied by the statement of P&L, statement of financial performance, big asterisk, go see this other section that discusses the disciplines that exist today.
Shall we give the... Just
one quick comment. So based on the Nick's suggestion, just that they invested like a reconciliation. In that case, maybe it might be very easy to accept everything by just amending paragraph 85A and small a. Because every requirement is the same. But if we modify this A, the debt subtotals be comprised of line items in accordance with IFRS. If we expand that kind of thing, including some other line items that are not in accordance with the IFRS, then maybe everything will be resolved, seems to me.
But I think that would open up the issue that everybody was concerned about allowing people to present something on the statement of financial performance that is inconsistent with IFRS requirements.
What I would like to, I think there was a discussion, but I think we ended somewhere, and which was Nick's suggestion, and so perhaps this staff could just think a little bit about the discussion that we had, that we our main concern was that the very identification of a measure as a key performance measure, management performance measure, could lead to a sort of an override of IS-1 paragraph 85, would get you there automatically. That is not what we want. Mm-hmm. So the extreme solution would be, the simplest solution would be that of Nick, but perhaps you could also get there that if you could more or less spontaneously come to us, could use paragraph 85 to create a subtotal, that would be, then you would be then you would not need an additional reconciliation in the notes. Not sure if I explained this correctly, but
I think it rather than sort of trying to take us out on this now, actually, is if we go away and we think about Nick's suggestion of a much more simplified approach to all of this and come back to another meeting with that suggestion and hopefully get it.
What is also very clear from this discussion is we need a solution that we can explain in 5 minutes.
I think that 85 and 85A is part of what we're saying, because that is how people in some countries have got these line items and subtotals there now. They've got it there by saying this is relevant. So if we can also keep that in consideration, because then that will speak to Francois's point about that there are some people that want it up there on the face, clearly identifying it as a relevant thing.
I think somehow in the end we have to get some better commonality of understanding around the world about what paragraph 85 and 85A actually mean.
Yeah.
And how they're applied.
Yeah, and could it be that in some jurisdictions the regulators don't really allow application of 85, if that's the case?
Yeah.
I mean, yeah, so is that IFRS compliant, though they think it is?
Well, I'll pick up Sue's point and go and have a look if things have changed, but there are points where the regulator has come down and said, "This we're not going to do it this way." Anyway, I'll have a further look at that.
I mean, that would be an interesting discussion with our friends from IOSCO. Okay.
The next paper that we have is on adjusted EPS, and it's very much reliant upon the decisions that we end up with on the management performance measure. So my suggestion is that we skip that paper for now and move on to the paper on associated growth ventures and hope for a little bit more success for the site.
Thank you. So we're dropping that one for now?
Yeah, because it's different.
We need to have it.
Okay, so we are moving on now to a slightly different topic regarding the statement of cash flows. So I would like to discuss agenda paper 21C. This paper discusses whether the board should require separate presentation of the investing cash flows of integral and non-integral associates and joint ventures in the statement of cash flows. The reason why we are bringing this paper to this session is because in January we had a discussion about the split between integral and non-integral associates and joint ventures in the statement of financial performance, and some of the board members asked us to analyze the same split for the statement of cash flows, so that's the objective of this paper. So as part of our analysis of the first issue in this paper, 21C, the staff identified some of the investing cash flows that can arise between an entity and its associates and joint ventures. So we just identified these investing cash flows. We didn't add up anything that is not already in IS7. These are existing investing cash flows that may arise. But then the question, we then consider whether these investing cash flows of integral and non-integral associates and joint ventures should be presented separately, whether there should be a split between these cash flows. And then the next question was, and if so, if there should be a split, then where should we present this split? And then in Appendix B, we set out some potential approaches for presenting this split and these cash flows. So moving on to issue 2, discussed in paragraphs 13 to 18 in this paper. The question that we are asking is, should the board consider requiring that the investing cash flows of integral and non-integral associates and joint ventures are presented separately? As we explained in paragraph 16, our answer is in the affirmative, because such a split would be beneficial for users. And we also recommend in paragraph 13 that the basis for distinguishing between integral and non-integral associates and joint ventures should be the same that you tentatively approved and decided for the statement of financial performance. So the question below paragraph 18 is whether the board agrees with these staff recommendations.
Yeah. Just a clarification. So when I read the paper, I thought that it implied to me that the cash flows from investing activities in paragraph 16C, etc., were limited to cash flows between associates and joint ventures, but I think in fact they could in theory be other debt and equity investments in, for example,
that's
under
correct.
IFRS 9. So I think as a result, if it were material, you could in fact end up with a three-way split, could you, between associates and joint ventures that are integral, those that are non-integral, and then other investees?
Yeah, that's effectively what it would occur. Maybe we were not that successful in illustrating that in the illustrations, but effectively you would have a three-way split.
I don't... last time I didn't really like this integral non-integral split for the income statement. I don't really like it anymore now it's turned up in the cash flow statement, but it's more disaggregation, which I don't object to. I actually like, so I'm not going to object to it.
Mary?
I think I'm probably in a similar place to Sue, but I want to ask a question about how far we will go in our statement. If you look on page 15 at paragraph B2, this is the recap of what we decided about the split between integral and non-integral and how it would be formatted. It's clear that we're saying that integral joint venture should be outside of income and expense from investment. Are we clear that I think we're showing how we expect it would be shown, i.e. after profit from consolidated entities. But I think when it comes to the P&L, we have to be clear that it can't be included as in a subtotal that's profit from operations with no other subtotal above, because that would mean that you're not distinguishing between consolidated and non-consolidated. Now, I'm not trying to reopen our January decision, but it came into focus for me when I was looking at the cash flow proposals. On the one hand, I think if we've decided for P&L to separate integral and non-integral, we should have a consistent treatment in the statement of cash flows. But I would be concerned if the cash flows between an investor and an integral JV or associate were presented as cash flow from operations. And it's not clear to me from this paper whether we are precluding that or not. I would be okay, given the decision I didn't agree with, but I accept it as our decision to separate integral and non-integral. I think we should carry that through to the statement of cash flows, but I would not be okay if we thought that meant you could or should present cash flows from related to integral JVs and associates as part of operating cash flows.
Well, first of all, that's not our recommendation.
Okay.
Because as we are arguing in the disadvantages of approach A, that is against the nature of the cash flow. The cash flow by nature is investing. The cash flow that arises between the investor and the joint venture and associate.
Even if it's integral?
Even if it's integral, yes.
I just think we have to say that explicitly. This, the fact that you are presenting it separately does not change its nature as investing, and therefore it must be included as part of investing cash flows and not as part of operating cash flows. I just think we have to say that.
That's things like dividends and acquisitions of interest and associates and things, isn't it? Potentially.
Yeah.
It's not sales between these entities.
Dividends.
Yeah, exactly. We are talking about cash flows that are investing by nature.
But I think people just think of it as, well, I've decided it's integral, therefore it should be part of my operating cash flows.
I agree, and I had the same email.
The reason why we brought this alternative, approach A, that sounds, I agree with you. It's against the nature of cash flow. The reason why we brought it is because it was kind of we had an equivalent alternative when we analyzed the statement of financial performance. So we brought it just because it was mirroring that. I think it was also approach A in the last paper. However, we made the clear point that it doesn't really make sense to have an investing cash flow as part of operating activities.
It wasn't clear to me reading the paper that we'd reached that conclusion. I thought that's what we meant, so I thought I supported the staff recommendations in issue two. But I think that it should be clearer, and I'd like this to be clear in whatever.
Yeah, I think we've sort of drifted into the second question here as well in terms of looking at presentation. And perhaps one way to make this crystal clear is to think again about our starting point for the cash flow. Obviously, we decided on the starting point, then we had a debate about the treatment of associates, whether we're going to have integral or non-integral. We agreed to do that. If we were to start our cash flow statement at whatever we could call it, business profit or operating profit, it then becomes very clear that you only take in the dividends in through the cash flow statement in the investing section. You don't have this rather awkward reconciliation of you have to do deduction. And then I think that really makes it very clear that it is investing in that respect.
I would like to support Nick's suggestion. As a matter of fact, it was one of my proposals on issues, the third issue. I support the recommendation of the staff, and I think it's important to, because I had to go through that thinking on the basis of this paper. I think in previous discussions and previous decisions that we've made, we have consciously decided not to align the definitions of investment activities in the statement of performance with the investing cash flows category in the statement of cash flows. And so having the two GVs lines in the statement of performance included in different subtotals, to me, is not inconsistent with having them together in the same subtotal of the statement of cash flows, because the investing cash flows category in the statement of cash flows really encompasses everything, the acquisitions and disposals, those flows, including flows for the acquisition of operational items, operating items, like the capital expenditure. Mm-hmm. And I felt that, and eventually in a consultation document, I think this should be highlighted. We're not being consistent. On the contrary, these two definitions are not aligned, and they serve, in a way, different purposes. So, and I think that would be good. And I also thought when reading the paper, and I was... I agreed with what you have in your issue 1, 11 and 12. I was surprised that you didn't ask whether we would agree. But I think it's important that we all agree that your conclusion, paragraph 12, is our conclusion. Because it also participates in remaining consistent with our definitions.
So, point I raised last time, and I'd make a distinction that we decided not to take on the task of integrating the cash flow and the performance. I did comment that I didn't think we should create more conflicts between them. And I think the suggestion is that we do so. And that makes me look, because I realize it's a bridge too far to bring everything in. Whether we should just then throw up our hands and say we're now going to have a world where we make no effort whatsoever to pull them together. And if I sort of were to test this, I think, with the suggestion, and imagine an entity that had nothing but integrated subsidiaries. My understanding is on the statement of financial performance, we will put something in a line item where we would have a big, let's assume they make money, a positive profit, and then down below we'd have the line income before investing, whatever, right?
Mm-hmm.
And on the cash flow statement, we would have cash from operations zero, and then we'd have a whole pile of investing.
Yes.
Okay. And we don't do that anywhere else. Like, revenues are in operating, collections are in operating, purchases are in operating on the cash flow. Cost of sales is in operating on income statement. So I'm a bit concerned that we're going to depart and create a new one.
also, when I sort of run it on this extreme example, I get a bit concerned. I also pull back to just how important the cash from operations number has become over time. You know, if you go back, there's lots and lots of evidence. There was the huge opportunity to make money by recognizing splitting earnings into cash from operations and accruals. Right, and people went out and made a whole pile of money. Hedge funds set up things to do this. There was a recognition that cash from operations were typically more persistent than the accruals. So if you were analyzing, so that was important. Again, the evidence, sort of the recent paper, that although earnings is less relevant, or the bottom line, that income is less relevant in terms of explaining returns or prices, accounting as a collective by Barth is actually at least as relevant, partly because of the importance of cash from operations is one of the items that comes into play. So cash from operations is an important item, and it seems to me that we ought to have some principles in there behind it. And I'm not keen on throwing in additional differences between the two statements, which is, I think, where we're headed.
But isn't this consistent with the way that we treat things like the acquisition of property, plant and equipment? Property, plant and equipment can be used as part of operations, and this is all about the acquisitions and returns from associates and joint ventures.
And that's why I went back to my initial, is we said that we weren't going to try and fix the existing places of departure, and capital expenditures and depreciation is the single biggest one that we have, and it's a bridge too far. I'm still back, though, saying if that would have been a nice thing to do, I'm still hesitant to create new ones, which was the point I made last time. And I think creating new ones is somewhat problematic. And for every one we create, if you run a stress test like in the one I just gave, put it out on a sort of the end of the tail, nothing but integrated subsidiaries, what signals do I get? I get a very kind of perverse signal from my cash from operations, totally running against the importance of the cash from operations today and what we learn and its correlations with returns and profits. So if I just get zero.
Nick?
Yeah, I disagree with Tom's analysis in that today there is no consistent starting point for cash flow from operations. There is no definition of cash flow from operations. There may be in North America, often there it starts at net, or generally starts at net profit, but elsewhere in the world there is no consistent definition. I guess what we're seeking to do here is to bring, at least to the IFRS world, a consistent definition. So I don't see this necessarily as a step backwards. And it's the call that we've always had from users is we'd like a definition that is high up the income statement, so we don't have to do these convoluted add backs. Mm-hmm. So
and I'm with you. That's why I was in favor of a lot of the changes we're making, because we're getting much closer to a definition. And I do want the common starting point. I'm still a bit concerned that we'll pull this one item and put it in two places. I don't think it's the end of the world. I think it's as big an item as it could be. But as a matter of principle, I would rather be reducing items than increasing the number of items where I get a distinction on the two. But I'm totally agreed we should build a proper starting point. We should work our way down. We should be as consistent as possible, which is, in fact, one of the reasons.
I mean, at the moment, our integral joint ventures are between operations and investing. They're in no man's land anyway at the moment, in terms of our definition of
financial and then we're going to voice.
Okay, thank you. First of all, I agree with Tom's point, because some empirical research has found that information with regard to cash flow from operating activities is useful. The problem because of the definition of the income of expenses from investment and the definition of the investing activities is not inconsistency. Because if we look at the income, the definition of income and expenses from investments, those investments are assets that generate a return individually and largely independently of other resources held by the entity. These assets are different as defined in the definition of the investing activities under the IAS 7 I said that investing activities are the acquisition and disposal of long-term assets and other investments not included in cash equivalents. So that they include not only they include PPE or other actually operating assets, but they all include it. So this is the problem. The concept of definition, the starting point of the assets are different. So whether we need to go to revisit, when we revisit the definition of the investing activities, I think maybe we will not. So this is the difficulty we are facing now, because the definition has been defined there, and they include not only the so-called investment assets, but also including other assets in the definition of the investing activities. This is the problem. And if you look at the definition of operating activities, actually it's based on the definition of investing activities. So this is the problem, because we did not directly define the meaning of the operating activity. This is the problem.
We did.
But I think we were not open this is a big issue now. Yeah. So I don't think we
can.
Sure. How does this fit with the direct method? But we're looking at indirect method presentation for indirect method cash flows.
Well, in the direct method, you would basically have that split, that same split that you see with between integral and non-integral.
Yeah. Okay. This doesn't have any implications for direct method.
No.
Okay, great.
And I see who supports the staff's recommendation.
It's question one.
Yeah.
Well, it's a question on issue two.
Issue two.
I was waiting for 11.
Yeah.
So, well, even though you have expressed some comments already about issue three, I'm going to briefly present it. This issue three, discussing paragraphs 19 to 37, addresses some alternative approaches for presenting the cash flows of integral associates or joint ventures. And these alternatives are listed in paragraph 22 and explained in Appendix B. So the staff recommends Approach B, which is a separate presentation of integral and non-integral associates and joint ventures within the investing activity section. And this is for the reasons outlined in paragraphs 29 to 30 of the paper. So does the board agree with this recommendation?
Next suggestion.
You mean with the starting point?
The starting point we move to the business profit from consolidated entities.
I mean, I like B, but I'd like to have the starting point, as Francois says, starting from business profit or operating profit. I just think it's simpler for preparers, and you don't have to do this funny reconciliation in terms of deducting the share and then putting it back into the operating. It's just much more straightforward.
I would just remind the board that at the December meeting, we asked the question to the board about whether about the starting point for the indirect reconciliation of cash flows, and the board specifically decided that the starting point should be the one that we are showing in the illustrations. And also, we asked the board whether we should relabel that subtotal at the time. Operating profit, and the board said no.
But it was before the January decision to split.
Yeah, that was before we had this split. However, I would just like to remind you.
Thank you.
Okay. Do we support the staff's recommendation?
Was it with or without?
Well, yeah. The
staff recommendation is without.
Yes, the staff recommendation did not consider a change to the starting point of the indirect reconciliation. Mm. Our recommendation was the presentation of the split between integral and non-integral within investing activities.
And approach B.
Approach B, yes.
And we can vote for approach B and ask for revisiting the starting point.
But I see people wanting to be
listed. Yeah, thank you. I do not disagree with approach B because it is consistent with the current cash flow statement dealing with PPE. So as far as the cash flow of acquisition of sales, it should be investing category. However, when it comes to the dividend, as we discussed, some of the dividends are closely related to share of profit or loss. Suppose you pay out all of the profit for the year as a dividend, then the share of the profit or loss and the dividend amount is identical. But the dividend goes to investing category, investing activity, whereas the share of profit would be profit before investment. So it's quite inconsistent. And if you look at the dividend, it's also quite complicated. Some of the dividend are dividend from the going concern basis, daily earnings. So it is consistent with the share of the profit. However, there are dividends which would be paid out as a final payment when you terminate the associates. So it's almost like a sales of associates. So just about the dividend, if we go down to the approach B and try to consistent with our profit or loss statement, then we have to segregate the nature of the dividend. Otherwise, it can't be consistent with profit or loss. So that is the problem we may have if we go down the path to the approach B. So I'm not quite sure you have an appetite to segregate those dividend, or you just simply live with the inconsistency between profit or loss and cash flow statement. Do you live with the
What you're suggesting, I think, is approach C. I think that what you're saying is that you would support approach C instead of approach B.
However, not actually. Approach C treats dividend and acquisition in the same place anyway. Just get out of the three categories. But my point is basically approach B is right because it is consistent with PPE treatment. However, dividend has a different nature, and as long as we are trying to consistent with statement of performance, last month we almost decided that integral associates share of the profit of integral associates goes to the profit before investment. So therefore, that part is inconsistent. And especially, not only simply just a dividend, you have to look at the nature of the dividend. That is the point I'm raising.
Yeah, but at the November meeting, we discussed the classification of interest in dividends.
Yeah.
We agreed that dividends received would be included within investing cash flows.
Yeah.
So approach B is consistent also with that decision.
Yeah, I understand. So that means
making a slightly different point.
Yeah, but that means do we live with inconsistency between
He's saying some dividends are disposal proceeds, so they wouldn't be in the income statement.
But I think we're okay because if you look in the glossary, the definition of dividends is distribution of profits to holders. And so therefore the
legal
final distribution of capital would, I think, not be caught as a dividend.
It's a sales.
Whether it's a sale or whether it's a payout of the capital.
So in that case, all of the dividend will be somehow inconsistently presented between statement of profit and the cash flow statement.
Well, I think the example is just assuming simplistically that this is a dividend, like a normal dividend.
Normal dividend,
I wouldn't read into this that if you had such a huge dividend in its nature was actually a disposal. That's fine.
If it's a normal dividend, then I'm saying that there is an inconsistency between cash flow statement and the statement of performance. If we go down the path to the having a profit before investing category, because share of the profit or loss goes to the above the a profit before investment.
Yeah, that's right. You can't read straight across. You can't read straight across from the investing category in the income yeah. statement to the investing category in the cash flow statement, because in the income statement we've segregated the non-integral, the integral associates as outside of that yeah. investing category. And I think we acknowledge that when we're looking at alternative B. But what we say is that we think the nature of most of these cash flows okay. between the associates and joint ventures is investing in nature when you look at the sort of definition of investing within IS 7.
But also, I'm a little bit confused about your comment on dividends received impacting the statement of profit or loss, because, well, in the equity method, dividends received will decrease the carrying amount of the investment. So that will be from the perspective of the same financial position. Am I wrong? Yeah.
Sorry, I'm not with you.
What's in the P&L yeah. is your equity pickup?
Yeah, it's in not the P&L, you, exactly, you would have the equity method. You yes. share yes. the share of profit or loss
yes.
resulting from the equity method.
Yeah.
Now, the dividends received, if you read IAS 28, they reduce the carrying amount of the investment.
Yeah.
But that's the investment recognized in the statement of financial position.
Yeah, I do understand. But the number itself came from the same profit, and the dividend received will not appear on the profit or loss statement, of course.
Okay. Uh-huh.
Of course, that's a matter of course. But what I'm saying, if you pay out all the profit as a dividend and then recognize the share of the profit, then basically the nature of the source of the profit is the same, but presented separately. That's my concern. Because the share of the profit goes to the above the investment category. So that is the separation we would see. If we go down to the approach B.
Quick question. Clarification lecture. So the approach C is more consistent with the approach for statement of financial performance.
Yes.
But still, you are proposing approach B.
Yes.
Why?
Why? Because, first of all, because it would be consistent with our previous decisions on interest and dividends, on the previous decisions we took on the statement of cash flows. Also because we are arguing in the paper that would effectively create a fourth category in the statement of cash flows, and we don't want to introduce more complexity. And the third reason is because effectively those investing cash flows that we have identified arising between the investor and the associates and joint ventures are cash flows that are investing by nature according to the definitions and all the dynamics in IS 7, all the definitions of investing activities. So they belong there.
I think it's best illustrated by the acquisition of Integral Associate X. In a sense, it's almost as though an acquisition cash flow is very close to an operating cash flow, and it's not actually in there, but it's above the investing category, right? So I think whereas with the decision that was made on the income statement, I didn't agree with it, but the board thought that the performance on the associates was sort of, for integral associates, was closely aligned with operating performance. It was fair to elevate it so it was sort of up in that area, but I think the staff are saying it's sort of a step too far to go all the way to saying that things like acquisition and disposal cash flows are sort of close to operating cash flows and not investing cash flows, which was Francoise's point about there being a sort of different psychology going on in the investing concept in the cash flow statement, which is what Tom's objecting to, but I think this illustrates.
I would make a distinction between the acquisition to me or analogous to capital expenditures, dividends are much more basically the cash version of the equity income.
Gary? I think voice support for the staff's recommendation. I think ultimately you have two choices. You can be more aligned with the P&L, more aligned with the IAS 7 definitions of dividends and so on. and they're really sort of binary. I mean, I think the question is which is either more disruptive or which is more useful. I think B, on balance, I mean, there is no perfect solution. I think on balance, I think B is more useful ultimately. They sound like investing activities, and well, they are, you know, and I don't think it makes an improvement to treat them more like operating. I think you got the right recommendation. I think to me the more important one was all the trading back and forth, operating, you know, and the buys and sells and stuff of inventory and services and whatever else, which also makes sense if it's integral, you know, it's part of your operations even though it's unconsolidated.
Mary?
Three things. One, I agree with the staff recommendation. I was attracted to approach C because I like the idea of carrying through from, you know, while I don't necessarily like the decision we made, I think having made it, there's something nice about carrying it through, but I agree with you, Denise, that the complexity of introducing a fourth category is a much bigger step than we want to do in this project. And so therefore, I come to the point of saying we draw a line in IFRS standards that says if you're an associate or joint venture as opposed to a consolidated entity, when it comes to the statement of cash flows, you're reflecting dividends, you're not reflecting earnings, you're not doing proportionate consolidation of the statement of statement of cash flows of the investee. Therefore, I agree with your analysis that when we focus on the dividend payments, even though, as Tak says, that their underlying source, the spring from which they come, is operations, we are accounting for them as dividends because of the boundary of the reporting entity. Mm-hmm. So therefore, I support the staff recommendation. The other thing, though, going back to Nick's point, is I'd ask the staff to think about whether we should or shouldn't. You know, I think we should reconsider, and maybe we should reaffirm or maybe we should change the conclusion about what the starting point is for the reconciliation for the indirect method, given the decisions we made subsequent to taking that reconciliation starting point decision for the separation of integral associates. I just think it's worth coming back as a cleanup point on that. I'm not sure what I want the staff recommendation to be, but I just think we should circle back and look at that. But that it's not a condition of how we vote on issue 3 for me.
Okay. Who can support the staff's recommendation?
Ten in favor, one absent.
All right. We're done. Thank you.